Hi, Will.
Ben, how you doing?
You call him Will?
Why not?
He's second in command of the ship, that's why not.
I'm not Starfleet, I'm a civilian. When he's in here, he wants to be treated like a civilian.
Riker, I bet he sleeps in his uniform.
You only think that because he's your CO, if you got to know him.
Right.
He's convinced Commander Riker doesn't like him.
Why? Did you crash the ship into something?
No, he just doesn't like me.
He doesn't even know you.
Transfer complete.
Hello and welcome to Subspace Transmissions, the podcast where two Trek fans step into the arena and tackle the best, worst, weirdest, wildest, and everything in between that Star Trek has to offer. I'm Cam Smith, and joining me on the bridge,
this is Tyler Orton, begging my commanding officer to let me stay on for another shift like a total keener.
Like you do for this podcast every week.
Every week. Cam, can I do one more, please?
You've been saying you want two episodes a week.
Yeah.
Well, this week we are going to talk about Battle of the Junior Officers.
Yeah, I think what we really want to address here is kind of like what it means to be a junior officer on Star Trek. Because usually, I guess we see it from the viewpoint of all those people in, you know, the observation lounge, the guys that are making the big decisions. There are some exceptions, of course, throughout all the casts that we've had, but primarily we focus on the senior officers, mm-hmm. but we have gotten some glimpses into what life is like as a junior officer. I think we're going to use the most notable ones here. Of course, Lower Decks, one of the big TNG episodes, and Good Shepherd,
yeah,
which kind of took a different sort of twist on that particular Lower Decks format when you focus on the junior officers. And after that, I want everyone to stick around. We're going to have a conversation about those two episodes, and then we are going to get all the junior officers to battle it out, Cam. It's going to be fun. We're going to have brackets. We're going to talk a little bit about the officers, and then we'll defer to the computer, a.k.a. Majel Barrett's going to be telling us who's going to go on to the next round, and
right.
We'll determine who the greatest junior officer is of all time. So it's going to be a fun one. But before I jump into that, I was looking and doing some research, and we never really had a DS9 episode that kind of delved into the junior officers. But Ron
right.
Moore has a quote where he was like, well, we always considered those smaller, more ancillary characters like the Roms and the Litas, like those were our kind of like, you know, I guess Lower Decks sort of episodes, the ones that focused on them. So that's kind of an interesting perspective on, you know, I guess the differences between the series.
You could also argue then they actually did much more with those characters than the other series, because
yes.
TNG and Voyager had those select episodes where they focused on them, you know, their single episodes, but it's not like they did a lot.
I know, unless, you know, I'm still hoping that because CBS is so desperate for Star Trek content that we'll get that Samantha Wildman spinoff one of these days, you know.
Here's hoping.
She'll be Lieutenant Junior Grade Samantha Wildman, and I would imagine her daughter Naomi is now the captain of a ship at this point, telling her what to do.
Now, how many pitches would they have to go through before the Naomi Wildman spinoff comes up?
I've got a solid answer.
Okay.
11.
You think just 11?
Just 11. They loved Naomi Wildman on
it's
Voyager.
True.
I didn't ever quite get it.
Scarlett Palmer has a bit of a TV career, doesn't she?
Yeah.
What show was she on?
She was on the Bill Engvall show with one Jennifer Lawrence. I could totally be mistaken, but I think that's what the show was. Like, she was on, like, some sort of, oh, no, was it Reba?
I was thinking Reba.
Yeah.
I was, like, trying to remember if it was her or another Star Trek kid who was on Reba, but I think it was Scarlett Palmer's.
Yeah. Either way, it was one of those kind of sitcoms that I think did really well in, you know, kind of maybe the Red States or something that. And so
have you ever seen an episode of Reba?
I think I saw like 30 seconds of it.
Yeah.
Just to see if Reba McEntire could like act. Because my parents, they were big into like Reba McEntire growing
right.
up as a kid. A torturous drive homes from school that listening to JRFM here in Vancouver.
Right. So. I used to always get her mixed up with Canadian song legend Rita McNeil.
Oh, no way I would ever get those two.
Not in
up.
Terms of how they look, but in terms of just the names. As a kid, I was like, neither one of them interested me, so the two names would blend together into one.
Okay. Now that we've lost all our listeners today, let's get into it. It was so much fun to go back and watch Lower Decks. This is just one that I have so many great memories of, and it is amazing. I think the format of it was perfect in that, remember, we have the senior officers go into the observation lounge, and then a plan unfolds. And from the viewpoint of the junior officers here, they don't really know what's going on, except they kind of piece it together.
Right.
If they were all, you know, allowed to talk to each other like the senior officers would, they could probably figure out what happened to Ceto Jaxa, who was the character that we met during the first duty just a few right. seasons earlier. So, I mean, what was your overall take on about how the life of junior officers is depicted here, Cam?
Well, you know, you said at the top of this episode, like, we're trying to figure out what the life of a junior officer is like on Star Trek. I think this episode nails it 100%. Where, yeah, these characters don't really know what's going on. They have to try and piece together information, and they can't even share necessarily information because yeah. they're, you know, it's information that you can't pass on. And so I thought it was really fascinating to watch these characters dealing with high pressure situations, but not knowing what they're doing. And it really made me think, I don't want to serve in the lower ranks of a starship. I think I'd rather be at the top, you know, where I know what the you know, the deal is.
It's kind of, can you imagine having that conversation with Captain Picard that Ceto yeah. Jaxa had in yeah. the ready room, where he's like, just like, I don't even know how you made it on this ship.
Yeah,
you know?
Exactly. Like,
you don't deserve to be on this ship.
Oh, that's a brutal scene.
I would crawl out of there crying.
Oh, well, back in the day, I used to work in community TV. And I really loved the time and years I put in doing computer graphics or script assisting in the control room upstairs, because you knew what was going on.
Yeah.
But there was periods where I would be down on the floor doing camera work or, you know, floor directing or things like that. I did not enjoy that, because you could hear over your headsets, everyone in the control room is kind of talking to one another and coming up with ideas for the show, and you're just like down on the floor, like waiting for direction.
Well, even think about like that scene that we had between LaForge and Tarek.
Yeah, yeah.
In which Tarek's kind of giving advice. He's saying, here are my ideas, Commander. And LaForge is like, great, thanks.
I know. He's such a jerk. I mean, okay, we see a few of these, you know, classic characters acting as mentors to these young people. We see Riker with
Sam LaBelle.
Yeah, Sam LaBelle.
Yeah.
We see Tarek, of course, with Geordi LaForge. We see Jaxa with Worf.
I thought that was great Worf stuff.
And also a little bit of Picard
yeah.
there. And then
Ogawa and Crusher, too.
And Crusher. Who do you think are the ones that come off good for the characters, and which ones come off a little rough for your established cast?
100% Crusher comes off like the best. Like that.
I think Worf comes off pretty good, too. But yeah.
But between the two of them, I would say Crusher still takes it by a country mile. Like, oh, that yeah. is the commanding officer that I would want to have.
And you'd
want
to work hard for her,
no
too.
No kidding. And it was amazing, because Ogawa seems to have like a way better head on her shoulders than any of her friends.
Okay,
on the
well,
ship.
I got a question. This is a little bit of a diversion here.
Yes.
How old do you think Ogawa is supposed to be on this show?
Okay, so she's a nurse. I would peg her at, you know, this point in the series, 25, 26.
Yeah, that's kind of what I figure too, because she's hanging out with these other characters who seem to be in the same age bracket, right?
Yeah.
But like, Patty Yasutake was 40. When this episode was
okay.
shot, or, yeah. or 39 or 40,
yeah.
just like 3 or 4 years younger than Gates McFadden.
Okay.
But the way she's talking to Gates McFadden, it's like felt like they're definitely writing her as a young character.
Yeah.
So I was a little confused, because I'm like looking at her going like, well, she doesn't look significantly younger than Gates McFadden.
Well, she was actually up for the Keiko O'Brien role
yeah.
as well. So they wanted, I think, somebody age appropriate for O'Brien. But
right.
to me, I always kind of read her as somebody who I guess was like 15 years younger than that.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think it worked. I mean, it shows
definitely did. Yeah.
What kind of actress she was there.
But you can see there's a little more maturity just to her acting style
than her
co-workers, the other lower decks characters.
I agree with that.
Yeah.
But you mentioned the Worf and Jaxa relationship mm-hmm. as well, which I really have to hand it to Worf. This is one of the few times on TNG that he actually looks like a competent, like, commanding
yeah.
officer. Like,
yes.
We got that a lot on Deep Space Nine. But I really like that scene where, you know, they're doing the, you know, Klingon ninja stuff, and
right.
he's just like, maybe next time you shouldn't take so many bruises before saying something's unfair.
Yeah.
And she realizes she needs to go talk to Picard and be like, hey, man, not a cool thing that you did to me earlier. What's up with this? And I love that mm-hmm. Picard comes back and says, you're right. I wanted you on my ship because I wanted to ensure that you got a fair shake in, you know, your career in Starfleet after what happened at the Academy.
Yeah, yeah.
I love all the scenes like that went just back to back like that. Like, it reemphasizes why, you know, Starfleet is something that people should strive to be in, you mm-hmm. know, and this was great. But Cam, what do you think of maybe the Sam LaBelle Riker parallels here?
Oh, man.
Who comes off worse, Sam LaBelle or Riker?
I think, you know, Sam LaBelle is a character who, there was talk about bringing some of these others back, and obviously Nurse Ogawa is a regular on the show as it is. I was not surprised when I didn't see anything for Sam Lavelle being a character that they considered bringing back in some capacity.
Yeah.
I think like Dan Gauthier in the performance doesn't come off great. I think he feels a little bland. But I do enjoy seeing this sort of young version of Riker. And apparently, I didn't catch it. I don't know if you did. I read about it actually after the fact on Memory Alpha, but like he does the Riker maneuver in the episode where he does the leg over the chair.
Oh, I missed that.
I missed it too, but apparently it was there intentionally to show that he really is this young Riker.
Okay.
And so like I do like Jonathan Frakes just not giving this guy the time of day at all.
Oh, it was perfect though. But yeah. But I think it's perfect then. Look, it was very on the nose, but that poker scene
definitely
where yeah. Riker is successfully bluffing and Sam is unsuccessfully bluffing. And
right.
It shows that, yeah, you know, there may be a lot of similarities, a lot of parallels between these two characters, but you know, experience actually counts for something. There's a yeah. reason why Riker is where he's at this point.
I think it's interesting, though, it does not show a lot of self-awareness on Riker as a character in the sense that, like, Troy is the one that points out he's a lot like you were.
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, what? No, he isn't. He's nothing like me.
So did you think he... Okay, well...
Like, I feel like Riker doesn't come off very good in this episode. He also comes off as kind of a jerk.
A little aloof.
Yeah. And
like, that smirk he had when Sam ordered the same ale and then left without drinking it, and Riker just gave him a smirk.
Yeah.
Like, I was like, oh, what a jerk, though.
Like, I kind of would have liked it maybe... look, I think this is a great episode. I love this episode. Yeah. But I would have liked it a little more if maybe Riker had been a little aware of this and realized that, like, what made him the William Riker we all know and love is that he needed someone to push him and kind of test him more.
Okay.
Like, he showed some insight into why he was treating... This character, I mean, I can
he
get it.
He needs like an Admiral Pressman sort of a mentor.
Exactly.
Okay.
I mean, do you think you would like your younger self or recognize them if they showed up? I don't know that I would necessarily.
I can say that I can acknowledge people that sometimes annoy me. It's often because they have traits that remind me of myself.
Right.
I would say that I'm decent at recognizing why somebody annoys me. It's generally because like, oh, that's exactly like me.
Right.
So I would hope that Riker would be able to do the same.
Yeah. I think Riker usually shows at least a certain level of self-awareness. And so it was kind of odd that he just shows none here.
Okay. But what about Sam? Like, how well does he come off where like the whole time he's like, Commander Riker doesn't like me.
Yeah.
And he eventually spells that out at the poker table where it's like, I guess I'm just saying that as an excuse in case I don't get the promotion. So I do like the fact that Lavelle at least has some self-awareness there. But for the first half of the episode where he's just complaining about Riker not liking him, it's like, do you really need to be a... Look, if you want to get a promotion, I think you need to be a people person.
Mm-hmm.
But he's making the mistake of being like a total like keener, like a kiss ass. And it's just kind of like,
But do you buy that young Riker was like that? Or do you think Riker was more of like a fake it till you make it type? Like he was walking around with the swagger, even if he didn't necessarily believe it, you know, until he kind of achieved it.
I think that Riker was the kind of keener who was last one off the shift, first one on shift.
Yeah.
He was the one who is going above and beyond. Like, I really believe that's the kind of keener Riker was, as opposed to the one who's going up to, you know, his commanding officers and be like, hey, I like Canadians. My grandfather was a Canadian, hey? And it's kind of like, okay. Like, Lavelle came off as so phony.
Right.
Though. Yeah. And I don't ever think that Riker was kind of that kind of phony sort of butt kisser.
Right. And we talked a couple episodes ago with Penny when we talked about Picard and what a great mentor he was. And I think at the time I talked about how Riker seemed like the more maybe approachable mentor figure. I think this episode proves me wrong in that regard. And that Riker just seems kind of off in his own world a lot when it comes to these junior officers.
Yeah. I mean, especially, and maybe we'll talk about this character a little bit later on, but watch an episode like Ensign Roe.
Yeah.
Riker really made it clear that he wanted Roe off the ship.
Right, yeah.
And whereas Picard is the one who's willing to take her in under his wing. And it is interesting how Riker kind of deals with, I guess, some of these officers that he doesn't necessarily respect just yet.
Yeah.
Whereas, speaking like, of which...
I was going to say, like, Picard is always very open-minded in that regard. Because Barclay, we talked about in a couple episodes ago or something, where... Picard was really willing to say, oh, he's a problem that's been passed around. Well, we're going to help him and we're going to deal with him. We see here with Sita Jaxa. Yeah, I mean, Picard is brutal to her in that scene where he's really dressing her down, but he's also kind of pushing her to fight back to a certain degree.
Yeah.
And he's the one that fought to get her there. So you can see that Picard, while kind of scary, as we see in this episode, is also someone who's trying to nurture young talent, whereas I don't think Riker is.
Yeah, well, think about, maybe we can do an entire episode all on Picard's mentorship, like, later right. on, but think about, like,
or even just the captains as mentors.
Yeah, no, I think that'd be good. Yeah. Mark it on your calendars, listeners, sure. But, yeah, we've got, like, Picard and Wesley, we've got Picard and Roe, Picard and Barclay, Picard and Jaxa as well. I think there's, like, a...
The kids in Disaster? Yeah.
Yes. So, yeah, but what about the Tarek and LaForge?
Oh, man.
Like, okay, here's the... I totally get that Geordi, we've talked about before, he's kind of a jerk, and fans don't really seem to acknowledge it that often.
Right.
But wouldn't Tarek just be, like, the biggest pain in the ass to have as kind of a junior officer, though?
Yeah, I mean, Tarek, he's a know-it-all. And the thing is, Geordi's a know-it-all, but Geordi is also, in many ways, a man of few words. Like, he'll spit out commands a lot, some, you know, if he's in charge, but he's a character that's often very internal. And so if you have this internal character just getting peppered with endless suggestions, you can see how it would drive him crazy.
I just like when Tarek was just like, okay, here are my ideas. Geordi's like, great, we'll review them later on. Okay, what time? I'll get back to you on that.
Don't you think, though, like, Geordi is the perfect guy to have in charge of a Vulcan crew member? Because I feel like a Vulcan would not take offense to Geordi's iciness.
No, that's
whereas,
true. Yeah.
Like, I think some of the other characters, like, had you put, like, Sam Lavelle with Geordi, that could have been really uncomfortable.
I agree with that. Can we talk about more Geordi jerk moments?
Sure, go for it.
When Tark's just, like, scanning for life forms, no one told you to do that, Tarek. Or even when, like, he was shooting the shuttle with a phaser.
Yeah, yeah.
And Tark's like, it looks as if we're trying to make it look as if the shuttle's been damaged. Yeah, that's just a coincidence, Tarek. Just like, all this iciness. This is probably the most entertaining stuff to watch throughout the episode. But it's like, and I think fans forget this. This is typical Geordi LaForge. Like, this is actually how Geordi is usually from episode to episode. He's kind of a jerk to people. And,
right. Especially with, you see his staff. You see, like, those Barclay episodes. Like, he's a prickly leader when he's in charge of his engineering division.
Is it just that he's just such a genius when it comes to engineering that, you know, somebody like Picard will kind of tolerate that? Do you think Picard ever takes Geordi under his wing and be like, hey, man, you need to be, I guess, more the leader that people need as opposed to the one that you are right now?
I wonder if there's also, like, a refining of what the engineering department is from the original series to TNG. With the original series, it's kind of Scotty and he's kind of, you know, the good time guy. But I wonder if there was more of a concentrated effort with TNG to make engineering really seem like kind of like the science hub of the station, where, like, they really are the science brains.
So it's kind of like all those STEM students, and it's kind of like maybe that's just how they best get along, you know?
Yeah, maybe.
Forgo the niceties. And
when you look at the characters being thrown in there a lot of the time, you've got Wesley Crusher, who's obviously like a scientific genius. You've got Barclay. You've got Data. Like, they aren't, like, kind of the exuberant good time gang characters.
Yeah.
So it does make sense to me if they are being viewed as much more of, like, the kind of the brain section.
If there was a, I don't know, posting on the Enterprise D, what would be your preferred posting just based on maybe Lower Decks?
10 forward.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Let's talk about the Ben guy. I mean, he's not a junior officer, but like, I found this like a fascinating
device.
Yes. You know, like, he goes, you know, plays poker, cleans out the junior officers, and he goes in with the senior officers.
That was a weird scene. That was a weird moment when Ben walks in and just sits down with the senior officers. I'm like, this is not right. But there's something about this that feels very wrong to me.
But it's also as if the senior officers are acting as if, like, they've known him for like 5 years. It's like,
yeah.
No.
I get why this character was created, but it feels a little clumsy. Like, it feels very writerly. Like, this is very a writerly character. And the fact that they couldn't even be bothered keeping him on for a couple episodes down the road.
I mean, I justified, and I just mixed him up with all those other guys in the green waiters uniforms, you know?
Do you remember that Poochie episode of The Simpsons?
Yeah.
Remember when Roy moved into the house?
Hey,
with the family?
Mr. S.
Yeah, and they're like, hey, Roy. That's what he kind of felt like, that character who, like, shows up out of nowhere and everyone acts like they know him.
So overall, I mean, you know, I know we're talking about the junior officers, kind of the aspect of their life. We'll jump into Good Shepherd in just a moment. But as we wrap up here, I just want to say, I forgot what an emotional, like, episode this was. Like, this one really kind of hit me in the gut as I was watching it. This is season 7 where you're getting episodes like Masks or final self where Data is, you know, an Iceman on another like pre-industrial planet.
Yeah, Sub Rosa. Yeah, there's a lot of, or that one with Paul Sorvino as Worf's stepbrother.
Yeah,
there's a lot of episodes that just aren't very good. But in season 7,
they can still, you know, hit it out of the ballpark at this point. And I mean, this one, it hits me on a very emotional level.
I mean, the Sita Jaxo story is the heart of this entire thing. The other characters are there more for color commentary and just to show various aspects of the ship, how they operate on these lower decks levels.
Yeah.
But the Sita Jaxo story is what drives this whole episode, and it is just fantastic. Like, you see a lot of, you know, her tutelage under Worf, but also how this character is someone who is very much on the track to being one of these senior officers. Like, the other ones don't feel like they're that close to being your Rikers, your Worfs, your Geordies. Yeah. Whereas, like, she feels like someone that has that kind of shooting star quality that she could be the main lead of another series. And I know there was a lot of talk about bringing her back on Deep Space Nine. They were going to try and keep her death ambiguous in this episode, but they ultimately realized, like, it was just too great an end to have her die in this moment on this away mission with this Cardassian informant. But well, I mean,
and what about that moment where Picard goes over the PA system and says, you know, I regret to inform the crew that we've lost somebody in the line of duty.
Yeah.
And I think that was a very powerful
moment. It's hugely powerful. And it's kind of feels almost drawn from some of the really, really good World War II movies, for example, where there's like the young soldier who dies, you know, near the end of the film, and they really wrap that into the story. And I really felt that same sort of tragedy to it, that, you know, these young lives are sent into Starfleet on these away missions and these adventures, that we look at the fantasy aspect of it going like, wow, they're going to go to strange new worlds. How exciting. But there is a level of tragedy that happens on these missions. And how often have we seen red shirts just die? You know, on the original series, it was all the time.
Or why was this a more powerful episode emotionally than what Tasha Yar got Skin of Evil?
Although she did get like a 25-minute funeral. But I mean, Sita Jaxo.
It was actually 3 minutes. It just felt like 25 minutes.
Riker, you always made me laugh.
I just want to remind listeners that Cam literally thought that Tasha Yar was buried on the holodeck. Like, it was just a mistake on his part, but that cracks me up to this day.
But anyways, like, Sita Jaxo, in this episode, I don't even know that I walked out of First Duty with this great sense of this is a profoundly powerful character.
Yeah.
Whereas, like, I walked out of this episode being like, wow, like, the actress just gave such a great performance. I thought she was incredible. Shannon Phil was her name, and she didn't really do a lot outside of these two Star Trek episodes. I think she has something like 8 credits or something on her IMDb. But I mean, she just hits it out of the park, and I can totally see why the producers were in love with her and why this character clicked with people so much.
Hollywood's a tough, tough monster.
But, yeah.
Look, Voyager, they kind of think of a different way to go about it, which means hiring one Tom Morello to play a junior
officer.
That
was also very weird.
We'll talk about it maybe in a moment, but it's essentially Good Shepherd.
I thought it was really weird when his character said he was a renegade of funk.
And then there's I'm sure, like, both Audio Slave jokes to make as well, but anyway.
I don't know any Audio Slave
I went, but okay. I was just remember, like, I was like, oh, this is an interesting idea.
Right.
You've got, like, one of the best singers ever in like, rock, and you've got, like, this cool backing band. And they just made music that I was just like, okay, this is like FM radio stuff. But Good Shepherd, Cam.
Right, yeah.
Between Rita McNeil and Tom Morello, I think we've just alienated pretty much all of our listenership at this point. But with this Voyager episode, essentially, like, Janeway finally identifies, thanks to Seven of Nine, like, 3 crew members that just really aren't up to snuff when it comes to, you know, expectations for Starfleet officers. She says, you know what? They actually have not been on an away mission. Let's see what happens here. So we get kind of like the Barclays of the crew.
Yeah, kind it's of definitely kind of the inverse of Lower Decks, where, like, those characters are all keeners.
And they're super competent, too, like, for where they are in their careers.
Definitely.
You know?
Whereas the group in The Good Shepherd, they're kind of the worst of the worst.
Yeah. So it's an interesting twist, and maybe let's kind of do what we did with the last one and kind of go through the characters and maybe their relationships, and in this case it was Janeway as, you know, the title Good Shepherd here.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it's obviously they have the relationship with Janeway in the episode, but I mean, it might be fun just to touch on the characters who actually are there their bosses on the ship and just maybe do a little hypothetical of like, how would this relationship work?
Okay, so let's talk about Seven of Nine and Celeste. Celeste, of course, is kind of the Bajoran character who just seems a little bit neurotic. You know, a very unsure of herself. She always needs to have her work double checked. What do you think of Seven of Nine as kind of a supervisor, though? Like,
that would be brutal.
It would be brutal. And I'll give you kind of a hint as towards, like, why other people would find that brutal. Remember the little nickname that Torres had for Seven in this episode?
No, what was it again?
She said, "What does a Borg queen want now?" I was like, whoa. You know?
Yeah.
So if that's what like the fellow officers or fellow crew members are saying about this, like I can only imagine how, I guess trying for Celeste would have been to have Seven as maybe a supervisor of sorts, a non-commissioned supervisor.
The thing about Seven is, like, you can see that Seven can be a really strong mentor to, like, say, the Borg children. Like, she's really good at that, and she's good with Naomi Wildman. But when it comes to this professional capacity, I don't know that she would be the best for what is basically a fairly high-maintenance coworker in this regard. Like, this young ensign is definitely... She needs a lot of help.
Yeah.
And I don't know that Seven of Nine would be necessarily willing to pitch in and help her and guide her in the way that she needs.
Is it perfect that, like, Icheb was, you know, the one who was getting kind of that mentorship from Seven? Like, I think those are kind of two peas in a pod.
Definitely.
And, like, Seven just would not be able to provide any sort of mentorship to somebody like Celeste.
Who do you think would be good with Celeste? I'm thinking Chakotay might be actually fairly good.
Well, remember Chakotay suggested we should just relieve them all of their duties and let them, like, I don't know, paint pictures in their like, recorders? Like, I actually was kind of really bummed out by Chakotay's response to Seven's, like, evaluation. Yeah. Like, can you think about, like, how dehumanizing that would be for those characters as well, where, like, you're told, you know, you don't really have, like, any sort of role on the ship.
They get put in Lon Suter's room?
Well, that's scary. The hole is still left in it after
Didn't he have a garden?
Yeah, he had a bit of a garden.
Yeah, they can tend the garden.
Yeah, okay. But I was honestly thinking that maybe, like, Kim could have kind of figured her out. Like, he could have worked with her. Like, I think that would have been okay.
Definitely, yeah. The thing about Kim is he is a genius, but he's also a little bit not the most confident and is fairly down to earth. And I think that would help her.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, speaking of prickly supervisors, Mortimer Heron has to... You know, I guess report into B'Elanna Torres, who...
That is a bad combination.
Oh, it is. You know what? Can I be honest? I do not blame Torres for giving up on this guy.
No,
I'm sure she gave it her, you know, all at one point. But you got this guy who's just nonstop, like, superiority complex, nonstop attitude. Like,
tell me about it.
Oh, yeah. You have to talk to one, like, every week on the podcast. You know? But
I've been locked in, like, a deck somewhere.
You're in the junction room.
I have, like, a little Harry Potter room you keep me in until we do podcasts.
Is that why you've got that lightning bolt scar?
Yeah.
Okay. But I think that's... I think sending him down to deck 15 was maybe the best for both of those
characters. I don't know what you do with this character.
I don't know either.
He's played by Jay Underwood, who... It's interesting. I was actually really familiar with this actor. He was in a movie that was actually a childhood favorite of mine. I don't know if you ever saw it. It was called The Boy Who Could Fly. It was from 1986, and it was...
I have seen this one,
I don't know if it was a big hit. I definitely saw it a few times as a kid and was really wowed by it. It wasn't one that I, say, owned on VHS and watched over and over, but it really had an impact on me.
Okay, am I correct in that it took forever for this kid to actually really...
Most of the movie, I think.
Yeah,
he was autistic in the film, and it's about these other characters kind of warming to him throughout and trying to understand him. And I think he does fly at the end.
Yeah, that's right. I just remember watching the movie like as a 4 or 5 year old saying, like, when are you going to fly, bro? Like, come on.
Yeah.
You know, like, I felt it was very misleading marketing.
Yeah, for sure.
Anyway, sorry.
But he also famously played the first ever Human Torch in live action in the Roger Corman Fantastic Four movie.
I'm just picturing Tobias Fünke dressed up like that.
Right. But yeah, so like Jay Underwood, it was really interesting to see him in this role because it is a character... You could see is sort of maybe like a little bit of a darker version of The Boy Who Could Fly.
Mm-hmm.
Because this character seems a bit on the spectrum in some way. They never obviously emphasize it on the episode, but he just seems a little bit that way. And you know what? I really liked watching him look, first off, him and Torres, bad combination. But I did like seeing him with Janeway, like where like Janeway recognizes the way he behaves and the way his mind operates, and she's trying to work with him on his level and banter with him. You can see she's frustrated, but you can also see she's not giving up on him.
Yeah.
And that she, you know, when he wants to do like abandon ship, she's just like, okay, it's fine. Like she's not necessarily giving him like the real like frown kind of look, or like really,
I think
like
Picard would have done that.
Yeah, definitely. Like Picard, Riker, Geordi, like they would have really dressed this kid down or given him a real air of negativity. Whereas I feel like Janeway is trying to understand him. And I actually think that really shines a really good light on Janeway in this episode.
Well, I think the writers knew that they had to make her come off looking great.
Yeah.
I wonder if in any other episode she would have had the same amount of patience for somebody who was like actively undermining her.
Yeah,
and dissing, like he'd be really disrespectful to
definitely,
her as well.
Yeah.
I was just like, oh man. The other thing I was fascinated by is that apparently the Delta Flyer has a full-size escape pod on it.
Yeah.
It's like, okay.
Sure.
Sure.
Maybe it was like a little inflatable one.
Okay.
Like it's tiny like and then it explodes out.
And what about Telford? Because the one that we see him paired up with most is a doctor here. I kind of don't blame the doctor.
Yeah.
And that if you've got this guy who's literally swiping medical tricorders, trying to get diagnosed with anything and everything under the sun, I believe the doctor's patience would be tried at that point.
With some of these characters, I was trying to figure out who they lined up with, because they do feel a little bit like we've seen. It's kind of like the Muppet Babies versions of certain characters. This one definitely feels like the Barkley of the story.
Yeah.
You know, and so, like, I, you know, was kind of interested in seeing this take on it where he is this hypochondriac, and the worst thing in the world ever happens to him.
Yes.
With these beings, like, burrowing under his skin. Like, oh my God. But he did feel like the least interesting to me of the group, and that he didn't feel like there was that much depth to him.
I would say that I would hope that if we ever got to see these characters again, that you'd see that maybe this away mission in which he literally had like this dark matter being invade his body that would actually help him get over some of his hangups.
Yeah.
You know, but we never really got that moment. I was kind of bummed out that the episode essentially concludes with Janeway waking up on the sick bay and looking at the unconscious crew members. I mean, and she
good
said,
job,
she says,
guys.
Yeah, she's like, job well done.
Yeah.
And it's just like, okay, you didn't necessarily have that emotional gut punch that like Lower Decks did, but it was a very interesting twist on something that, I mean, I think it'd be kind of, even though we're talking about Good Shepherd and Lower Decks, I would still say it's not derivative of Lower Decks.
Sure. You know? Well, when we did the Equinox episode just previously, last week, we talked about how those crew members who were brought in from the Equinox ship, we never got to see again, and that felt kind of, you know, like a really bungled opportunity. Do you think they should have brought back these characters? I know they did. They did bring back Celis in The Haunting of Deck 12. I just have no memory of her in that
episode. No memory of that either. You know, I think that that was kind of a lost opportunity. Like, I don't know if I would have had the patience to see, you know, Heron, you know, like, you know, eight more times.
Is there a character on the ship who could get through to him?
Okay. So, what about a Seven of Nine, like, Heron, you know,
I was thinking that because I feel like they might be able to understand each other on like an intellectual level.
Yeah, and at least appreciate what the other is trying to do.
Yeah.
Or it could just blow up in their faces and both
maybe,
of them would
maybe.
Be.
Maybe, but a lot of the time Seven of Nine comes off as condescending to some of her colleagues, even though she's not trying to. It's just the way she presents herself a lot of the time.
Well, that's where she gets her name, Conda Seven of Nine. Anyways, sorry.
And I think Heron does too. I think he's maybe intentionally doing it, but I could see how these two might be able to communicate and understand why they're expressing themselves in this way.
Yeah.
So I think that might be better than, say, like, B'Elanna Torres, who's a much more just fiery personality.
Got to ask you this before we get into kind of the next segment here on the podcast, but does Tom Morello not have, like, apparently the worst job? Like, he doesn't even get to do what Heron does. He just hangs out in the junction room and yells, "Captain on deck."
I know.
That seems like he must be just, like, noodling on his guitar in his quarters, like, all day long.
The thing is, too, I mean, these young characters we see in The Good Shepherd, they're all, like, pretty new. You know, they're crewmen. They don't have, like, major ranks or anything.
Yeah.
Whereas, like, the Tom Morello was, like, in his 40s at this point. Like, what did this guy do to wind up with this assignment at this point in his career?
He was hanging out in the junction room.
Yeah.
He just stood in the junction room, and he pointed people to Heron.
I know. It's really depressing.
Yeah, okay.
You're like, how long has this guy been on this ship? How long has he been serving in Starfleet?
My guess is that, you know, maybe it's just like a crew rotation mm-hmm. in that, like, everybody has to do, like, one day, you right. know, out of the year, or I guess 2 days a year, judging on the size of the crew, just in that particular junction room, and there you go.
Do you have any idea or backstory as to how this cameo happened or why?
I mean, I'm sure Morrell is like a Star Trek
just a fan. Yeah. And wanted on. Okay.
And I bet there's probably a producer who's probably a fan of, his music at that time. So,
right.
You know, there you go.
I guess.
I don't think Audio Slave was around when this one aired.
I think that was 2002 or something when they came around, wasn't it?
Yeah.
But I think they came around actually with the Hulk, that Ang Lee movie. I think they were tied into that or something.
Oh, yeah. Was that yeah. the
song? Or was that Velvet Revolver, maybe?
Oh, that was Velvet Revolver. Yeah. Yeah, well, that's right. I remember that song because it's like, didn't that movie end in Brazil and like they pulled away and it was, Velvet Revolver.
Great side projects there.
Okay. You know? Well, anyway. So why don't we kind of mosey on into the next segment here where we're going to be lining all the junior officers up, the very notable ones, you know. So we've got mainly ensigns, but we've got like a couple junior lieutenants here. Mm-hmm. And I guess kind of the criteria is we wanted all of our main characters who were ever depicted as an ensign at one point.
Right.
And if they weren't a main character, then at least they were showcased quite prominently. So, yeah, there might be some omissions, but I think this will kind of be a fun thing where we can just kind of talk about the value, briefly, and then we'll leave it to the one and only computer to decide who's going on before we figure out who's the best junior officer at all.
So all these promotions are based on randomness?
Don't say that. No, the computer is...
just wise and all-knowing.
The computer has an algorithm.
Sure.
Always knows who's most deserving of a promotion here.
So. It's like V'ger. It's the next step in intelligence.
It's the human adventure, man.
Yeah.
Okay, so we'll start off first. This will be a fun one. One Ensign Chekov versus one Ensign Chekov.
Say what?
Yeah, from the Kelvinverse here, of course. So let's talk a little bit about Chekov versus Chekov. If you had to make a distinction, I think the most notable thing is, and I never really imagined this going into the 2009 movies, they would write this character as kind of a boy genius.
Doogie Howser.
Essentially, yeah.
Yeah, or you know. I guess you could say Wesley Crusher as well.
It surprised me. I thought you were just randomly saying Doogie Howser. I was like,
I do that sometimes.
Yeah, I'm used to it. Yeah. So, I mean, if I had to choose who I would promote, I may put, you know, Kelvin versus Chekov on it. He actually did get that promotion to chief engineer in Into Darkness.
Yeah.
And then he was demoted.
Right.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Is it just weird, though, that he is a boy genius who can do ship to ship, warp to warp transporting or what have you, but he's at the helm, you know?
Yeah.
Pushing buttons like as a navigator.
It seems like a lot of the jobs on Star Trek, they can kind of just easily slot people into with minimal training.
Yeah.
So I'm like, okay.
So who do you...
I'll just accept it.
But what do you think of original series Chekov as kind of like a leader? Because we do see him grow, you know, up to a commander throughout the movie
definitely,
series.
Definitely. Yeah. Chekov's a character who definitely feels like he grows into his own when you get to the movies. Within the context of the original series, though... Chekov is up and down. He seems competent sometimes, and then other times he's like absolutely ridiculous, like Spectre of the Gun, where he's just like wandering off, or even like in The Apple, he's kind of goofy as well. The Way to Eden, he's like kind of, you know, forgetting his duty sometimes. Like, I think Chekov kind of goes whichever way the writers wanted him to go. So sometimes he seems highly capable, other times not so much in the Prime Universe.
Yeah.
Whereas I feel like the Kelvinverse is maybe, well, you know what, Uhura's pretty great too, but I think of the Kelvinverse, I think maybe I prefer the angle they took on that version of the character versus the Prime Universe. I actually think they nailed down Kelvin Universe Chekov in a way that's much easier to define. Like, I don't know how you would define Prime Universe Chekov other than to say he's like, well, first off, he's Russian. That's like one of his big characteristics on the show, is to make these comments about things being created in Russia, right?
Yeah.
But also just being like young. Whereas I feel like the boy genius angle is actually really genius for explaining this character, why he's on the bridge, even though Kirk's a captain in like 6 months. Or...
Yeah. No, 24 hours.
Or 24 hours, I'd say. But how much schooling did he go through? How long is he in Starfleet Academy?
I think he did it was it 3 years?
Was it 3 years? Okay, well, that's better than, you know, than I would have thought. Yeah. But but you know, I think the boy genius angle on Chekhov is genius, and I think gives that character a sum up in a way that's really accessible and fun and sells why he's important to the ship.
Okay, so we'll find out. We'll tell the computer to decide. Prime Chekhov is odd numbers. Kelvin Chekhov is even numbers. So we'll find out, computer, who's getting promoted. It is an even number, which means it's Kelvin versus Chekhov going on to the next round.
Okay.
Okay, so
Anton Yelchin is so great in that role, too.
Yep.
And I just love that they found interesting ways to use him.
Yeah. So next up here, we have one Robin Loeffler and versus one Wesley Crusher. And I think that's kind of a fun matchup here.
The ultimate game.
Absolutely. So I like this in that, like, Robin Loeffler was kind of, you know, depicted as someone who's ultra competent. Like, she had... look, Geordi seemed to like her just fine, you know, which is kind of a good attribute you could say here. Whereas Wesley, he's really had his up and downs throughout
first
his Starfleet
duty.
Career. Well, he had, first duty... For one,
why was Picard so hard on on Sita Jaxo over first duty, whereas like Wesley kind of got a little bit of the pass?
But you know, Picard had his chance to ream him out in first duty, though.
Sure.
But I mean, Wesley, he eventually kind of leaves Starfleet, so I don't know. I'm kind of coming down on Robin Loeffler myself. What about you?
I agree. Like, Robin Loeffler is a pretty great character. She's one of those ones that you just like to think, like, what would have happened if she'd been a recurring character for the rest of the series?
I think we would have been a movie star right there. Instead of doing Double Jeopardy, she would have been Star Trek First Contact.
Had she blown up, you know that she would have been in those movies.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, for sure.
Okay, so Loeffler is odds. Wesley is evens. It is even, so Wesley Crusher is going up next.
That Wesley always survives to the next round. That's why he's in so many seasons, despite the fan hate mail.
All right. So here's kind of an interesting one. We can discuss that one. Esri Dax, who we were introduced to initially as an ensign, and then she's promoted very quickly to lieutenant junior grade.
Very quickly. One season.
I think one episode, essentially, yeah. And we're going to have her go up against Tilly, who met as a cadet, and we saw her for about, I'd say, 2.5-3 minutes as an ensign by the season finale of Star Trek Discovery, season one.
Now that I think about it, it does seem kind of odd to have a cadet on a ship like Discovery.
Well, I think you need to get a little bit of field work in, and so...
But that ship feels very, like, I don't know, experimental...
But you know what? They're at war. I think they need to get everyone they can.
That's my line. It's war.
Yeah. So, for you, I mean, who would you rather have under your command here? Because I think we paired them up because they're both kind of initially... You know, introduces more neurotic sort of characters, unsure of themselves.
Yeah.
Ultimately, you have Esri, who has just how many lifetimes of experience? Like 9, 10 lifetimes of experience at this point. I think Tilly, who is, again, just in one season, just like Esri was, she's still coming into her own. I still think we have sparks from her. We got the Killy stuff, so she was starting to show she could have kind of those chops in command.
Right.
So, I don't know. What would you... actually like, though, from a junior officer camp?
This one's difficult. It really is, because, and part of it is me looking at what Tilly contributes in terms of her job. Like, we see a lot of the scientific stuff she does dealing with Stamets, and I kind of feel like, because we haven't seen a lot of counselors on Star Trek since Deep Space Nine, and so I kind of maybe wrongly value what Tilly brings to the show versus what, like, Esri Dax does.
Okay.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, I get it.
And so, like, I don't know if that's maybe incorrect thinking on my part, but I think I would side with Tilly for that reason, for that bias I have.
I'm going to go, you know, with Esri. She just has so much wisdom.
She does, Like, I really like the character of Esri, but I feel like...
Looking at an episode like Field of Fire, where she is starting to come into her own, you know, with the whole Vulcan sniper.
That is such a weird episode.
it's a memorable one.
Yeah, and then there's also that episode where her family are crime lords.
That was the less said about Prodigal Daughter, the best. That was not a good one.
Yeah.
That might have been the worst of season 7.
Yeah.
Anyway, so Esri is odds. Tilly is evens, and the computer says, who's getting promoted? Even. So Tilly is going on to the next round here. Alrighty.
Awesome for Tilly.
Yeah.
You got to have the character who drops the first F-bomb go on to the next round.
I like it.
Yeah.
We don't speak that way on our show, Cam.
That's only for family-friendly Star Trek.
Okay, here's another fun one. We're going to have helmsmen go up against each other. We have one, Paris, because remember he was demoted to ensign for quite a significant period of
what
time.
What was he before his demotion?
He was a lieutenant. Okay. I think it was weird because remember like there's like all these different ranks that the characters had when the series first started. Like Tuvok was initially a lieutenant commander, or at least his pips were.
Right.
And then he had lieutenant pips, and there's a lot of weird costuming issues going on here. But so I believe Tom was like lieutenant junior grade.
Was that when they were sharing uniforms with the cast of Star Trek Generations?
No. They never shared uniforms.
I thought they shared some of the Voyager uniforms. Am I wrong about that?
No, it was Deep Space Nine uniforms.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
So anyways, Paris versus Mayweather. Mayweather, apparently based on the series finale, he spent about 10 years as an ensign, which is even more depressing than one Harry Kim. So who would you rather have behind the wheel of your own starship, Kim?
Let me read a quote from an author. It's okay. David Greven, who wrote the book Gender and Sexuality in Star Trek. He says, Travis Mayweather, the helmsman, is African-American and a complete blank, rarely given even one non-techno-babble line an episode. Without the slightest exaggeration, it is entirely accurate to say that Nichelle Nichols Uhura on the original Trek had more lines of dialogue.
Yeah.
You know, it really shows that like Mayweather is a character who was just given nothing. I've been doing a rewatch of Enterprise, and this character has no defining characteristics other than job related things.
I think it's perhaps one of the biggest failures on the parts of the writers in Star Trek period, in that like
Anthony Montgomery is great. I actually think I rewatched the episode Horizon the other day, which is the one where he goes back to his old home cargo ship. And I actually kind of like that episode because it actually showcased that he could act and that his character had interesting qualities if you actually gave him things to do.
Well the issue wasn't Anthony Montgomery, because look at an episode like Inamir Darkly, where you actually give him like interesting stuff to do, and he does it really well.
Yeah.
And I just think the writer should just kind of be ashamed about like how they just totally kind of, honestly, I'll just say it, I think it was just kind of a token character that they figured they'd stick on the show, and then they did absolutely nothing with. And I don't know. I don't get it. And so I can't really give him like the sympathy votes, so no. I have to give my helmsman vote over to Tom.
Exactly. The reason I read that quote is basically there's nothing for me to hang on to with this Travis Mayweather character as much as I want to, because Anthony Montgomery seems like a blast.
Yeah.
And so I want to love this character, but there's nothing there. Whereas like Tom Paris, he has personality, he has some spark. I think Robert Duncan McNeil has some really fun moments. I think he's comedically enjoyable to watch.
Yeah.
And the character seems hyper capable, except for turning himself into a salamander, but we'll look past that. So I got to go with Tom Paris.
Okay. So Paris is odds, Mayweather is evens. Computer, tell us. Odds. So it is Paris who's going on.
Right.
But at least Mayweather never got demoted, so you got that.
Two good episodes he got for, you know, showcase episodes, I guess, but just not enough.
Like, what, 98 episodes?
Yeah.
And he got two.
Unacceptable.
No, unacceptable. Here's an interesting one. We've got one Hoshi Sato versus one Ro Laren. And I think if it was up to me, Hoshi would be my go-to person. And, like, she's hyper-competent.
Yeah.
She seems as if, you know, she's there to just do her job as well as she can, and without, like, kind of pushing back against the commanding officers. And it wasn't as if, like, Ro was, like, wrong all the time. It's just, like, she had a different way of, expressing herself that didn't necessarily flow with kind of Starfleet style.
If you ask me which is the more interesting character to watch, I'm going to come down on the side of Ensign Ro.
Yes, I agree.
I think Michelle Forbes is amazing, and I love watching any episode with Ro. I think she just contributes so much in terms of dramatic stakes to what she brings to the episode.
Hell yeah, yeah.
However, as a crew member, I have to side with Sato, who, despite her initial kind of space phobia, I think is really great and contributes a lot to the show. And I like the chemistry she has with the cast. She seems like a really good team player. Plus, we should also mention Hoshi Sato is, according to the Emmys, the ultimate representative of Star Trek Enterprise.
Yeah, for those who did not catch the Governor's Ball, or what was the award? Anyways.
It was like the technical award.
Emmys, but yeah, they were celebrating Star Trek there, and she was the representative there. So, okay, so Sato is odds.
Yeah. Plus, you know, and Hoshi's not going to defect to the Maquis at the end as well.
Sato is odds and Ro is evens. So what does the computer say? It's odds. So we have one Hoshi Sato going forward now.
I've really had good luck, and all the ones I've picked have gone on to the next round. I'm very happy.
Here's another fun one. Torek from the Lower Decks, as we were just talking about.
Yeah.
Versus Vorek from Star Trek Voyager.
Okay.
Both Vulcans played by the same actor.
Jerry Taylor's son.
That's Jerry Taylor's son. A little bit of nepotism there. Yeah. One of whom we got some good comedic beats with Geordi LaForge. And
the other one, we got Blood Fever.
We got Blood Fever, one of the most horrifying toxic masculinity episodes that we've ever experienced in all of Star Trek, which is actually saying quite a bit.
Yeah, see our Ponfar episode for more on that one.
Yeah. For me personally, Torek's a bit of a know-it-all, but he actually seemed to know his stuff.
Yeah.
I didn't really get much out of Vork about what he is like as maybe like a junior officer.
I am racking my brain to come up with things that Vork contributed other than Blood Fever material.
Yeah, he was in like 8 episodes.
Yeah, he was in a number, but wasn't he mostly just kind of doing technobabble type stuff?
Yeah.
Yeah, like he was fine. I just don't really have a strong impression. Whereas like Torek, he seems like a keener who could be annoying, but he also really seems like he knows what he's doing a lot. Like, you could see with some maturity, this character could grow into, like, you know, a Spock or Tuvok-type Vulcan where they contribute a lot to their crew.
Once again, Cam, is the studio too cheap to pay the writers royalties? Because it's essentially the same character.
Would you say their personalities are the same?
No.
I'd say Vork comes off icier.
I absolutely agree with that, yeah. So,
but I think Torek would have been much more interesting to see on Voyager.
Just to carry that on and see how he developed. Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so Torek is odds.
There was
and
a rumor that if TNG was renewed for season 7, Torek would be a recurring character.
TNG, thankfully, was renewed for season 7.
Or sorry, season 8, I should say.
Yeah. Maybe. Yeah. So Torek is odds and Vork is evens. And the computer tells us that, it looks like Torek is moving forward here.
Awesome.
Thank you, computer. Yeah, we've had pretty good luck so far, I'd say.
Yeah, this isn't when, like, Kodos almost got to the end of our alien leaders.
That was kind of disgraceful.
Yeah.
But, okay, so
the computer was on the fritz that week.
So, coming up next, we have Nog v. Kim. They're kind of like, I don't know, how would you describe them, Cam? What's kind of similar between them?
Well, they are both kind of like the youth characters on the show, especially like Nog, who we've seen as like a child coming into his own as a, you know, young adult. And Harry Kim, despite, I wouldn't say Garrett Wong comes across as like a young kid on the ship, he's very much treated like a young kid on the ship.
I'd say in the first like season for sure.
Yeah,
where
he's
like playing his clarinet.
Well, I don't know, even when you get to that episode, The Disease, in like season, what is that?
Like, I think that's like five.
Yeah, yeah, sure, it's a ways along. The conversations he's having with Janeway are very much like a teenager sort of talk.
I agree.
Yeah. And so, like, Harry Kim is always kind of occupying this weird role of, like, the kid of the crew. Whereas, like, do you think Garrett Wong carries himself on the show like a really young character?
Does he carry himself that way?
Yeah.
He's definitely treated that way. But I would actually say it's dependent on the material. When he's just doing the technobabble thing, or he's just buddy-buddy with Tom? No, not necessarily.
Yeah.
But a lot of the Janeway, Kim, or Chakotay and Kim scenes, it's very much them kind of talking down to like you would like maybe an 11-year-old or something.
Right, yeah.
So, but Nog, we get to really see his journey from, you know, civilian to cadet to a battlefield commissioned ensign to chief of operations on Deep Space Nine. You think about his upward mobility in Starfleet versus one Harry Kim.
Yeah.
I wonder, did Harry get screwed? Is there a reason why he never got promoted? Like, what's the deal there?
It just the circumstances of being in the Delta Quadrant on Voyager?
But I'm sure Janeway could have given him kind of that. Well, she demoted Tom.
That's true.
I'm sure she could have given him, you know, kind of a battlefield, like, promotion.
It'd just be good for morale.
No kidding. 7 years, no promotion.
Yeah.
Sam Lavelle, how long was he on Enterprise D before he got that extra pip?
And he was kind of a jackass.
Yeah, no kidding.
Harry Kim is pretty by the book.
So, I mean, for me, I'd have to say, like, Harry seems super competent.
Yeah.
But Nog, there's got to be a reason why this guy, like, goes from, like, a bucket thief in episode 1 to having O'Brien's job by the final episode.
I wonder, though, how much of Nog's quick ascension had to do with the Dominion War.
Oh, I think a lot.
Yeah,
a
whereas, like, well, you know, you can't even compare them because Harry Kim's circumstances are equally extreme. But
he survived 8472.
Yeah.
Battled the Borg, you know.
If I'm assembling a crew, though, I think Harry Kim might be the better choice.
Okay.
Like, I feel like Harry Kim, you could rely on him in a pinch at all times.
Yeah.
Nog, I don't know. Like, I love the character of Nog. Aaron Eisenberg kills it in that role, but I don't know. He just feels young and inexperienced in a way that Harry Kim doesn't, to me.
Okay, but it's interesting because they both have the same job by the end of the series. So who would you rather have on ops? Like, it's interesting. You're saying Kim?
I think Kim.
I'll go with Nog. Okay. You know, there must be a reason why he had that quick ascension. So
I can't disagree with Nog as like the more compelling character.
Yeah. Okay, so Nog is odds and Kim is evens. Evens going forward. Kim, I think you're doing quite well right now, aren't you?
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm loving it.
So finally, here's a bit of a funny one. We'll do a bit of a throwback to Lower Decks versus Good Shepherd here. We'll have Tal Silas versus Cito Jaxa. These are the two Bajoran crew members that are unsure of themselves. They seem like kind of... Silas is a bit of a ripoff of Jaxa, but not quite. But I would... Okay, can I be honest? Is there much of a discussion?
Nope. Cito Jaxa for the win.
Okay, let's see what the computer has
to say. There was actually like an author, I think, who said that Cito Jaxa was the best character in the history of Star Trek. I thought that was fascinating.
Interesting,
That's an extreme opinion, and I like it.
She had a very clearly delineated two-episode arc, so I get it.
She's great.
It's evens here, so that means that one Cito Jaxa is going forward next.
She survives another day, which is more than we could say for her episodes.
Okay, so we're going to head back up to the top of the brackets here, and we're going to have Kelvin versus Chekov versus Wesley. You pulling for anyone in particular? These are Chekov. Both kind of the know-it-all sort of like space boy geniuses.
Totally. This is a really good pairing, but I feel like Kelvin versus Chekov is written more flawlessly than boy genius Wesley, who gets his really strong episodes, like The Game, for example, but a lot of the times it's pretty unbearable.
You know what? I got to give a shout out to Wes. Like, why not?
Sure.
You know, celebrate
you
Wesley.
You just like the sweater.
I've got three in my closet already. You know, how can I, like, deny the sweater superiority?
Right.
So, okay. So, Kelvin versus Chekov is odds. Wesley is evens. And the computer says, who's getting promoted to lieutenant? Evens. Kim, you finally lost. It's Wes, who's now a lieutenant aboard the starship.
I'd have promoted you, Kelvin versus Chekov.
it's there in thought, anyway.
Maybe he was promoted in the Kelvin verse. In the Kelvin verse, he actually did go on.
Okay. I can only hope. Yeah. Now we have Tilly versus Paris. Who are you gunning for in this particular? I think Tilly is a more interesting character.
Definitely.
Who would you want under your command at this point?
You know, Tom Paris, when you iron out the kinks, like that episode, is it 30 days or something like that, where he's imprisoned in his cell, in his room?
I think it's in the brig for...
Is it in the brig? Yeah. Like, you know, you can see that Tom Paris has his issues, but I think Tom Paris is pretty damn great under pressure as a navigator. I would go with Tom Paris. I think Tilly... Further down the road, I may side with Tilly.
Yeah.
But at the point in the series I've seen her at so far, like, she's just not at the level Tom Paris is at.
And we definitely had that journey with Tom where he started off kind of unsure of himself.
Yeah.
And by the end of his journey, like, he kind of grew into his own. He felt so much more comfortable in his own skin. Like, he was kind of like the nerd of the ship by the end, where he started off as kind of the bad boy of ship, which is interesting.
Yeah. So he was like the domesticated bad boy by the end.
Yeah. Okay. So we're both saying Tom at this point. Yeah. So Tilly is odds and Tom is evens.
Both funny characters, too.
Yeah. I like it. Oh, it's odd. So Tilly is bitten Tom out.
I feel like this is the fan favorite choice. Like, I think more people enjoy Tilly than Tom Paris. Maybe that's controversial to say. I don't know.
I think there's a lot of Tom
you
fans
so?
Out there.
Well, actually, friend of the show and frequent guest Tom Ball, he was a huge Tom Paris fan. That's his favorite character in the history of the franchise.
And it's just because they have the same name.
Probably.
Let's be honest. Okay. So here's one. I can't say it's going to be the most dynamic battle, but one Hoshi Sato versus one Tarek.
Oh, boy. I'd go with Hoshi. That's not even
Hoshi.
A question.
Yeah, that's pretty easy for me.
Tarek's untrained, you know. Hoshi, you know,
I would much rather, like, hang out with her for an eight-hour shift on the bridge than I ever would with Tarek.
Yeah, it's interesting how hyper-capable characters like Hoshi are, who is an ensign when the show starts. Yeah, she has her phobias, but she gets over them pretty quick and seems very high-functioning, whereas, like, these Lower Decks characters seem, even after they've been on the ship for a while, still kind of bumbling to a certain degree.
So Hoshi is odds and Tarek is evens.
Mm-hmm.
Tarek has beat out one Hoshi Sato.
Wow.
Could you imagine if Tarek ends up winning this, Cam?
That would be the next Kodos.
Okay. Here's one. This is interesting. Harry Kim versus Seto Jaxa. I think Seto Jaxa has a more compelling arc in two episodes than Harry does in seven seasons.
What is Harry's arc?
I don't know.
I don't think he has an arc at all.
Yeah. And it's disappointing because, you know, I like Garrett Wong. He had some good episodes.
You could say there's a subtle arc in that he's just more comfortable with himself by the end of the series, but it's not like there's a lot going on there.
Seto Jaxa is a security officer that Worf thinks should have, you know, relief duty at ops. Mm-hmm. Harry's already at ops. Who do you think you'd rather have at ops now? I think maybe Harry, even though I find Seto to be far more compelling.
Yeah, I could definitely see Harry came at ops. Yeah, that makes sense. I gotta say, though, I really love how Worf pushes for Seto Jaxa to be promoted, because she's not someone on the face of it you would look at and say, like, that's the type that Worf is really going to want to champion.
Yeah.
And I really love that dynamic. I like to think he saw a little bit of Tasha Yar in her.
I think so. Yeah. Okay. So Kim is odds and Jaxa is evens. Jaxa's going on.
Awesome.
Sorry, Harry. You're not getting that. You're still not getting that promotion.
Hang on, Harry. It's coming in the mail.
Okay. So we'll go back to the top once again. It's going to be, this is interesting. Wesley versus Tilly.
Oh, really? Very similar characters in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
Well, the thing is, Wesley is as annoying as he can be. He's hyper capable, except when he's creating like robots, like in Evolution or something like that put the ship in danger. But you know, when he's down in engineering working with Data and Geordi, he seems just so strong at his job. I think I might give him the edge, but I'm willing to bet at the end of season two of Discovery, I would have come down probably on Tilly.
I'm betting on the future of Tilly.
Yeah.
I think there's so much potential for her, and we are going to see a very clear arc for her from where we start with episode three until wherever Discovery ends. So
yeah,
I'll go with Tilly. You're going with Wesley.
As of September 2018, I'm going to say Wesley. Yes.
Okay. So Wesley is odds. Tilly is evens. So it's Tilly going forward here.
Cool.
Alrighty.
Much more fun character.
Yeah, you're not going to complain about that. Okay. Okay, so this is an interesting matchup that we have here now. It's Torek versus Jaxa.
Is this really that interesting?
Well, they're both lower decks characters.
Sure,
It's like we have all these like very notable stars this series, and now we have two characters that ended up in a total of, I guess, three episodes.
Right.
A combined three for the characters. Right. Anyways.
I got to go with Seto Jaxa. I just think she would be a much better fit onto a crew than Torek, who can often rub people the wrong way.
Yeah, Jaxa is a far more interesting character, and I think she really had that very clear arc, and I'd much rather serve with her than Torek. So
you could see her as a regular on a different Star Trek series.
Oh, yeah, totally. So Torek is odds and Jaxa is evens. So we got Jaxa moving forward.
Awesome.
So Cam, the final battle to determine who the greatest junior officer is of all time, it's between Tilly and Jaxa.
This is actually a pretty great matchup at the end.
At the end, yeah. Here,
God Torek got knocked out last round.
That would have been kind of frightening. I'm pulling for Tilly.
Yeah,
but
okay.
Like, if Jaxa,
I gotta go with Seto Jaxa on this one.
If she pulls through, it's actually kind of a good way to memorialize the character.
That is very true. And if she loses,
it's just salt in the
wound. That much more tragic.
Okay. So.
Yeah, I mean, I just can't wait to revisit the character of Tilly when we get to the end of the road for Discovery, because you know, in the first season, she's talking about how she wants to be a captain, like. Is that the trajectory of this character? Like, we could be looking back at, like, the birth of one of the great Star Trek captains. Who knows, right?
Or else, who knows what happened in the Mirror Universe? Maybe she's already been replaced by her doppelganger.
Maybe.
That's what we'll discover in season two.
But what we have to go on at this point in time, I gotta go with Seto Jaxa, who just, to me, is just one of those characters that's lightning struck with that character.
Okay. So Tilly is odds and Jaxa is evens. Seto Jaxa is the greatest junior officer of all times, and we started this episode off
Yeah.
Talking about Lower Decks and what a great character she was.
I have no complaints with this one.
Okay.
There's that scene at the end of Lower Decks, to bring it back to that episode, actually, where Sam Lavelle is talking about how, you know, he got promoted, and he only got promoted because Sita Jaxo was killed in action. Do you think he was going to get that promotion if she had survived?
No.
Yeah. I feel the same way.
Not for an instant. Yeah. So it is a bit of a, I guess, a bittersweet pill that he's going to have to swallow there. But I think they had a very good, I think, was it Tark that said, you know what, serve it.
Yeah.
Do the best job you can just in memory of her and honor her with this. And I think that was great.
And serve he did off screen.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, so I think on that note, our assignment is complete. If you enjoyed listening to this podcast, jump on over to our Facebook page at facebook.com/subspacepod, where we'll have topics discussing the junior officers this week, as well as a video. Tyler, what are we doing next week?
We've been talking about this for a while, but we're going to tackle, I guess, more Deep Space Nine stuff, because I think you and I, we actually realized that we, I don't want to say we dropped the ball, but I think we were planning on acknowledging the 25th.
The baseball?
Drop the baseball. But we're planning on acknowledging the 25th anniversary of Deep Space Nine a lot more earlier this year.
Yeah, we were initially on track to do that.
Yeah, what happened was, though, is because there were plans for the What We Left Behind documentary. It was originally supposed to come out in February, and then it kind of got pushed back and pushed back. And all of a sudden, we realized we're in like August, September. And
we were also kind of hooped, too, because we were going to do kind of an anniversary for the premiere of Deep Space Nine. But that was when Discovery was airing.
Yeah, so we couldn't really tackle the Deep Space Nine. I think it premiered like the first week of January.
And yeah.
So it is a bad timing. So what we really want to do for the rest of the year is at least like once a month, we're going to do something with a big Deep Space Nine hook. And so this one next that we're going to do, it's going to be the evolution of the Ferengi, which I know there's some fans that aren't huge Ferengi fans out there, but I think this is actually going to be, whether you love the Ferengi or you hate the Ferengi,
yeah,
this is going to be a fun one where we just look at how one of the most iconic aliens in Star Trek started out and where they left off and became very layered,
right?
You know, so
I'm really looking forward to delving into some of the TNG missteps in the early days when they were trying to turn the Ferengi into like their main adversaries.
And there are also a lot of missteps in Deep Space Nine as well.
Yeah.
But yeah, look, they appeared in every single series except for Discovery and the original series. I also wonder if maybe we can...
They are going to show up on Discovery.
Well, I think we'll have to speculate on that. And it's going to be fun for us to kind of talk about what the future may hold for the Ferengi. Are you surprised that they haven't been in the Kelvinverse yet? Or just like even a cameo appearance? Like, I think they could have had a lot of fun.
Yeah, I am actually surprised they didn't work one in just even for a cameo.
In all fairness, they were not a species that we're very familiar to. They're more like a rumored species in the 24th century at that point, and until, you know, they actually had the last outpost. Because even on the Enterprise episode, like the crew never actually saw the Ferengi aboard the ship, so... Anyways, let's say that,
but they work in like the Borg as well in Enterprise, and I know they've talked about how they want to bring the Borg into Discovery. So it's like, believe me, if they really want to work the Ferengi in, they find ways.
Have they talked about wanting to get the Borg into Discovery?
The designers have talked about how they would love to design the Borg for Discovery.
Okay.
Yeah. So
I hope the writers aren't having that conversation. You've gone to that well already once.
I know.
I don't want them to keep doing that again. Like, we have so many Borg adventures.
No, definitely. You know. I agree with you, but...
So anyways, to sum up, look for next week, Evolution of the Ferengi.
I think this is going to be fun.
Yes.
Okay, so you can also find us on the Twitter. I'm at Cam, V as in Vorik, not as cool as Torek, Smith.
You can find me at Reporton, that's R-E-P-O-R-T-O-N. N, as in Nog, look for him in Evolution of the Ferengi coming next week.
Okay, so until next time, the arena is closed.
Transfer complete.